Oh, good evening. I'm going to see what I can do tonight. I woke up this morning not feeling well with some severe allergy things going on, and I dumped my morning sermon on Tom at the last second. And by 11 o'clock or so, I felt pretty good. I told Tom that I should be able to do this abbreviated sermon this evening because of the meeting later. Shouldn't be any problem at all. And then about 3:45, everything came right back. And I didn't want to drop it on Tom at the last second again. I'd hate to use up all of the IOUs on that all at once in one day. So I figured that this is abbreviated. It may just get a little bit more abbreviated, and we'll work with this as we can. Well, as you remember, we've been going through a series of lessons talking about the different analogies of God that there are in the Bible. We've looked at six previously. Unfortunately, the last one of those was right before my lengthy trip out of town. And then Tom has been doing a little bit more since he got back, and so there's been a pretty big gap. But just to give you a little bit of a reminder, we've talked about the biblical imagery of God as an architect, God as a craftsman, God as a farmer, God as a king, God as a warrior, and God as a shepherd. And I've been saving for last what is probably the most prominent of all of the analogies of God. It's so prominent that sometimes we don't even think of it as an analogy, perhaps. But if you'd think of it, it would be the one that would come to your mind first of all, which is God as a father. And I don't use the word father here at the outset, although that's what I'll use most of the way through. Well, here on the slide, as you see, I've got the word patriarch, and I'm choosing that word at the outset because in the ancient world, fatherhood involved a whole lot more than we think of it today. And while some of the imagery that we may think of in terms of fatherhood would certainly apply to the idea of a father back then as well, it was more than just that. Today, the father is the head of the individual nuclear family, father, mother, and children. And that's kind of the best case scenario in the world today, or at least in our particular culture, our particular corner of the world. But grandparents and siblings and cousins are far removed from our daily life most of the time. A few visits here or there. But that's not how it was in the ancient world. The patriarch of the family was not just the father of a nuclear family, of, you know, the head of his individual family, of his wife and children. The patriarch was the oldest living male in the family. And beneath him were his children and their children, basically all of the male relatives on that side of the family. The females, the daughters and such, would be married off into a different patriarch's household. But the oldest living male would be the patriarch over several generations that all lived under the same roof or in the same basic area. And it's not just them, but the servants and the stewards and others who were part of that family unit would be under his charge as well. And a person's identity, his status, his responsibilities, all of those things were determined by the family that they were a part of. And this patriarch determined a whole lot about the family. This society was obviously patriarchal, which is to say that the authority was vested in that oldest living male. It was patrilocal, it is called, which is to say that all of the relatives on the male side, like I said a moment ago, lived in that same location, the father, the sons, the grandsons, the great-grandsons. It was also patrilineal, which is to say they wanted boys. Male children were preferred because they would continue that family line. And so when we think of God as a father, it's really a much bigger picture in the biblical context than it is in our world. And again, our ideas of fatherhood certainly apply, but they barely begin to scratch the surface of the analogy. It's not just love and provision, which may be the main things that we would think of, but really final authority over everything and everyone that is in the household, control of the reputation of the entire household, authority not just over the family's decisions, but sometimes even over life itself. I mean, you look at some of the things that go on in the ancient world of fathers sacrificing their children. from time to time. Even you get a hint of that, of course, in Genesis chapter 22, where God tells Abraham to sacrifice his son. And he does that. And depending, of course, as we've talked about recently, on how you understand Jephthah's vow, there may be another case of that as well. But in outside of Israel, fathers had the right of life and death over their children sometimes. And these cultures included household codes of various kinds that outlined the proper behavior for the family members as they related to each other. Family responsibility, family honor was all tied into this. Everyone had responsibilities in this regard. And the patriarch, the oldest living male, was in charge of all of those different things. And so that's kind of, at least briefly, what it looked like in the ancient world. Now, as you move to the Bible and how the Bible talks about God as a father, it's very often emphasized that this is not a prominent analogy in the Old Testament. It's really in the New Testament where this becomes a much stronger picture of who God is. It's been said before that until Jesus prayed, our Father, no one ever talked about God in that kind of way. And there is some truth to that, perhaps. You know, there's no language in the other Jewish literature outside the Bible or in the Old Testament that ever used that word Abba to talk about God as Jesus does and then Paul will do after that. But there is this idea of God as a father in the Old Testament. Of course, that is a direct promise to the king in David's line. He will be my son and I will be his father. And all of the subsequent kings of that line would take that promise as well. But even outside of that, there are implications to that end. For example, in Psalm 27 and verse 10, the psalmist says, "When my father and my mother forsake me, then the Lord will take me up." And there is this built-in idea in that statement that God will serve as a father to the person who has been abandoned by his parents. And if that is the case, I think you can draw out of that the larger implication, perhaps, that the people understood this fatherly nature of God, at least to some degree, even then. Proverbs 3:12, Solomon says, when the Lord loves, he chastens, even as a father the son in whom he delights. And so you get this idea in the Old Testament, but it's certainly not as prominent. It's not as direct as it is in the New Testament. And so when you get to the New Testament, this really becomes a highlight and a key part of the image of God. Jesus says, "Pray like this, our Father who is in heaven." He tells Mary after he's resurrected that he is returning to my Father and your Father, inviting her and the apostles into that kind of relationship with God as well. He tells the disciples back in John 14 that he's going to the Father's house to prepare a place for them. They are going to be welcomed into God's house as God is a father to them. Of course, Jesus says, call on him as Abba Father. As we said already, Paul picks up on that language in Romans 8 as well, that we are sons and daughters who can call to God in this way. Which brings us then to the first key idea of the fatherhood of God as it relates to us. And that is this language of adoption that we find so frequently in the New Testament. For the sake of time and for the sake of my allergies, I'm not going to take the time to read all of these passages this evening. I would encourage you to jot these down and look at them as you have opportunity to. But in Galatians 3 and in Romans 8, Paul uses this language of adoption, and that's where he uses the Abba Father language that Jesus had used before. But also in Ephesians chapter 1, Paul talks about this being something that God had intended from the beginning of time. Ephesians chapter 1, verse 5, "He predestined us for adoption through Jesus Christ according to the purpose of His will." That God had intended this all along, that we would be His children, we would be adopted into His family. And this is something else that we can miss the significance of, because in the ancient world, adoption was different from how it is now. I mean, there are certain similarities. A child was brought into the legal status of being in a different family that he wasn't a part of before. But typically today, adoption is done For younger children, sometimes, very often, for infants, and it is something that is for the benefit of the child. And that's not always how it was in the ancient world. Sometimes it was for the benefit of the parents who had no heirs to adopt a child so they could have someone to carry on their family line. Excuse me. And beyond that, because very frequently adults were adopted in this regard, it had a kind of legal effect that we don't typically think of. Not only were they brought out of one family and put into another family, but it carried with it the removal of everything from their old life, from their old family. All of the obligations to their old family are removed. And beyond that, any past debts that they had were removed when they were brought into this new family. And all of those are kinds of some of the kinds of ideas that are wrapped up in adoption in the ancient world. In the eyes of the law, when someone was adopted, they became, for all intents and purposes, a new person. And so when we're adopted into God's family, it's not just that we become His children, but that whole picture of everything from our past life is gone and removed. The debt of sin is canceled. The relationship with the world and the old life is completely cut off. We're under a new patriarch who we are to be following. All of those things are wrapped up in this idea of adoption. But as you think of God as a father, perhaps in some of the ways that we would be more inclined to think of fatherhood in our culture, the New Testament touches on some of those as well. So, for example, in Hebrews chapter 12, and we won't take the time to really talk about this much, we talked about it some in our church discipline series, this idea of God chastening His children as a father chastens his children. He disciplines us to correct us and to make us better and to bring us into line with what He would have us to be. And no child likes to be disciplined. It's not something you look forward to. But in the end, you look back and you say, that was beneficial. I mean, I can't tell you how many people I know who were properly disciplined by loving parents who look back and say, I sure am glad they did that, that they trained me. You look around the world and you see those who aren't disciplined at all or who perhaps are abused instead of being disciplined, and you think, you know, how much better is it that I was properly disciplined and I can function in society as a responsible adult as opposed to these other options that are out there? And that's what the author of Hebrews is saying here too. You don't like it when you're being disciplined. You don't like it when you're being corrected, but it's good for you, and God does that very thing. He corrects us to bring us to be the kind of people that we ought to be. Also, Jesus talks about God's fatherhood as being a provider for us in Matthew chapter 6 and in Luke chapter 11. Here in the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus is telling them not to worry. Don't be concerned about where you're going to get these things that you need. And among other things, what He says in that context is, your heavenly Father already knows what you need. He knows what you need. He's inclined to give you what you need, so you don't have to worry about what you need. In the Luke passage, that's where Jesus says that famous thing about, you know, which among you thinks that if you ask your father for a loaf of bread, he's going to give you a rock instead? Or if you ask him for a fish, he's going to give you a snake? No father does that. That's not what fatherhood is about. And He knows how to give. He doesn't just know what you need. He knows how to give you what you need. And He only gives the good things that you need, because He is a loving Father who is seeking to provide for you the things that you need. And of course, you can't think about the fatherhood of God without thinking of the parable of the prodigal son in Luke chapter 15, where we find God's love and patience and forgiveness emphasized. And obviously, this is just one parable in a group of parables that are all intended to be read together. And obviously, this parable is not solely about, maybe not even primarily about, the love of the Father, but that is something that is in this parable. And the Father in this parable is different from the person in the previous two parables, the shepherd who had lost his sheep and the woman who was looking for the coin. Because in those cases, the person was actively searching, And here it seems that he's just sitting and waiting. But even though he's just sitting and waiting, the attitude is obviously there. He's not actively chasing his son in this parable, but the pent-up love and the agonized yearning for his son most certainly remains in this parable as well. The desire for his son's salvation and his son's return. And you see also in this parable how much the son underestimates the love of the father. And I can't help but think that we may do that sometimes as well. We're so concerned about, you know, our past mistakes that we wonder if God is truly going to be merciful to us, even though He has said He's going to forgive us if we confess our sins. The son here underestimates his father's love. Yeah, he's pretty sure his dad's going to take him back, but he's pretty sure his dad's going to take him back as a servant. And the thought of being received as a servant doesn't even begin to match what his father does when his father sees him. He runs out to him. He embraces him. He kisses him. Before his son has much of a chance to get anything out of his mouth, he's calling for a great celebration. And the son has to begin to realize just how little he really understood about the depth of his father's love. It is this immediate and complete forgiveness that you find in this parable. Well, you could talk about various kinds of applications along these lines, practical things to think about in your own life as you think about the fatherhood of God and these various ways of thinking about the fatherhood of God, as I encourage you to meditate on this more, find, you know, the other two dozen passages you could think of that talk about this same thing. One thing that I'll leave you with this evening is to think about this in terms of family likeness. The children look like their parents. And that kind of family likeness is one of those things that happens in a variety of ways. You know, sometimes they just happen to biologically look a lot like their parents. But that's not just it. You've noticed, I imagine, at some point in your life, how spouses begin to look alike over time. And there's a variety of reasons for that, but a lot of it is because their personalities mesh to the point that they look alike, even if they don't look alike, so to speak. They have the same kinds of traits, the same kinds of characteristics. They have the same sense of humor. They have the same way of thinking about things. They finish each other's sentences. And that's the sort of thing that happens to children as well. And as we have all been adopted into the family of God, we're not going to have any kind of biological traits of God where we look like Him physically in some way. And that's not what we're called to do. But we are called to be holy as God is holy. We are called to be perfect as God is perfect. We are called to love as God has loved. What he says essentially over and over is, look like God. And as God's children who have been given so much from him, how could we do anything but strive to look more and more like our Father? Back in Ephesians chapter 1, we find this idea in the parallels that there are in verses 4 and 5. Ephesians chapter 1 in verse 5, which we read already, he predestined us to be his sons, is the base of that sentence. There's more that Paul says, but that's the essence of it. He predestined us to be his sons. Well, parallel to that in verse 4 is he chose us that we should be holy. Those ideas go together. That because he chose us to be holy, he predestined us to be his sons. Because he predestined us to be his sons, he chose us to be holy. Those are inseparable. It's another way of saying we are to look like our Father. And he goes on to say in Ephesians chapter 5, be imitators of God as his beloved children. You see, sometimes kids look like their parents because they happen to look like their parents. And sometimes kids look like their parents because they want to look like their parents. They want to do things that their parents do. there's that age before they begin to realize that they know everything in the world, only to a few years later realize that they didn't know as much as they thought they did. But before that, their parents are the absolute greatest human beings on the planet. And all they want is to make their father happy. They want to be like their father. They want to look like their father. They want to do what their father does. They put on their father's shoes. They put on their father's tie. They put on their father's glasses. They play the games their father plays. They do the things their father plays. All they want to do is look like their father and make him happy. Be imitators of God as beloved children. Grow into the family likeness of God because he has adopted you into his family. Well, if you take your song supplement and turn to number 45, we'll sing that song now is a song of invitation and encouragement, as we always do, providing the opportunity here publicly if there's some way that we can help you, if there's anything we can do, won't you let it be known as together we stand and sing.